Chapter 9. He was alone in the barracks compartment. Haker and the others were out about the ship, executing his orders to take Eisenstein under their complete control. Distantly, Garrow thought he heard the faint echoes of bolter reports, and his lips thinned. There was only a handful of Grolgor's men still at large on board the frigate. Like his 7th company, the majority of the late commander's 2nd was scattered elsewhere about the fleet, with only a few squads here to oppose Garrow's plans. Kariah's willing agreement to take the Oath of Moment had cemented his trust in the shipmaster, and through him he had control of the bridge officers. He had no doubt there would be malcontents among the naval ratings, but they would quickly fall into line when the Astartes gave them orders, and if they refused, they would not live for long. By rights, he should have been out there doing the job of securing the ship himself, but the thundering churn of emotion inside him was making it hard for Garrow to concentrate. He needed a moment with his own counsel, to center himself in the face of the events that had been set in motion. Over and over he thought of the men he had fought alongside in the hosts of the Death Guard, and wondered how and why they could turn their faces from the Emperor. For the most part, his brothers were good and honourable men, and Garrow thought he knew the colour of their hearts. But now he doubted that certainty. The awful realisation of it was not that his kinsmen were ready to shake off the Emperor's commands and embrace treachery, but that most of them were merely weapons. They would not pause when orders came to them, even if those orders were beyond their comprehension. It was the lot of an Astartes simply to do, not to question, and he felt damned by the understanding that Horus would play that unswerving allegiance to his bitter ends. He had considered briefly the idea of opening up all of Eisenstein's Vox transmitters to maximum power and broadcasting the truth of the treachery across the entire 63rd Fleet. There were noble men out there, he was sure of it, warriors like Loken and Torgadon in the War Master's own legion, and Varan of the World Eaters. If only he could contact them, save their lives. But to do so would have meant suicide for everyone on the frigate. Every minute they kept their silence was a minute more for Garrow to plan an escape with the warning. Kinsmen like Loken and the others would have to find their own path through this nightmare. The message was far more important than the lives of a handful of Astartes. Garrow only hoped that once his mission had been fulfilled, he might see them again, either back on Terra at the end of their own escape, or here once more with the reprisal fleet at his back. For now, those men were on their own, as were Garrow and his warriors. The battle captain crossed the arming alcove that Caleb had set aside for him, seeing the Eagle cuirass mounted there on a stand. It was polished and perfect, as if the armour had come from a museum and not been battered in combat less than a week ago. He laid a hand on the cool ceramite and allowed himself to feel his full regret at the housecarl's death.
"You died well, Caleb Arryn," he told the heir. "You did honour to the Death Guard and to the 7th.
Garrow wished that he could promise the man's memory some form of tribute. He wanted to place the serf's name upon the wall of memory on Barbaros, give him the credit as if he had been a full-fledged battle brother. But that would not happen. Not now. Garrow doubted that he would ever see the dank skies of the Death Guard's homeworld again, not after the events at Istvan. Caleb's spirit would have to be content with the esteem of his master. Garrow's lip curled.
"Here I am, thinking of spirits, talking to myself in an empty room."
He shook his head.
"What is happening to me?"
Next to the cuirass, a bolter lay upon a folded green cloth, and, like the armour, it too was pristine and unblemished, fresh from the Legion artificers. Garrow took off a gauntlet and ran his fingers over the slab-sided breech. The weapon was deep with etchings in high Gothic script, combat honours and battle records listed along the length of it. There were names imprinted here and there, lined in dark emerald ink, each the name of a battle brother who had carried the gun into war and perished with it on them. Garrow's weapon had been lost to him on Istvan Extremis, destroyed by the brutal sonic attack of the Warsinger. Nothing but shattered brittle metal had been left. This bolter, then, was to be his new sidearm, and it was with bittersweet pride he took it up and held it to parade ready. A new name glittered on the frame. Pyre Rahl.
"Thank you, brother," whispered Garrow. "I will take a dozen foes with it in your name."
As was the way of the Astartes, Rahl's war gear was salvaged, and what could remain in use to the 14th Legion did so. In this manner, the Astartes kept the memories of their dead kinsmen alive long after they had perished. Garrow's eyes fell to find a carrysack made of roughly woven fabric lying forgotten in the corner of the alcove. He dropped into a crouch and took it up. Caleb's belongings. He sighed. When an Astartes died, there was always a brother ready to gather up the meagre possessions he might have left behind and see to them. But there were no provisions for a simple housecarl. Garrow felt an unfamiliar kind of sorrow over Caleb's passing. It wasn't the hard fury he had for the death of Rahl or the hundreds of others he had witnessed. Only now that Caleb was gone did Garrow understand how much he had valued the little man, as a sounding board, as a servant, as a comrade. For a moment the captain considered ditching the sack in the nearest ejector chute and making an end of it, but that would have been ignoble. Instead, with a gentleness belied by his large, heavy hands, Garrow traced through Caleb's effects. Utility blades and armory tools, some changes of clothing, a trinket made from a bolter shell. He turned the object between his fingers and held it up to the lamplight. A matrix etching of the Emperor stared back at him, beneficent and all-knowing. He pocketed the icon in a belt pouch. With it, there were dog-eared papers held together by a worn strap. In places, they had been taped where they had become ripped. Some of the pages were on different kinds of paper, some handwritten, some from a crude mimeograph with words smudged and blurry from hundreds of reproductions. Garrow found sketchy illustrations that made little sense to him, although he could pick out recognizable elements, iconography of the Emperor, of terror, repeated again and again.
"Lectitio Divinitatus," he read aloud. "Is this what you kept from me, Caleb?"
Garrow knew of the sect. They were common people who, despite the constant light of the secular imperial truth, had come to believe that the Emperor of mankind was himself a divine being. Who else, they argued, had the right to crush all other belief in gods than the one true deity himself? Was not the Emperor a singular, godlike entity? Despite his open rejection of such beliefs, the Emperor instilled such dedication and devotion. Immortal and all-seeing, possessed of the greatest intellect and psychic potential of any living human, in the eyes of the Lectitio Divinitatus, what else could he be but a divinity? Yes. Now Garrow saw it. He realized Caleb's connection to the cult of the God Emperor had been there all along, simmering beneath the surface. 100 tiny words and deeds suddenly took on new meaning in the light of this discovery. He had decried Grulgor on the gunnery deck for speaking blasphemy against the Emperor. And before, in the murk of his healing coma, Garrow had heard the invocation from Caleb's lips, the entreaty for protection.
"You are of purpose," he intoned flatly,
the housecarl's final words returning once again.
"The God Emperor wills it. His hand lies upon all of us. The Emperor protects."
He knew that it was wrong to go any further, that it went against the letter of the imperial truth he had dedicated his life to. But still Nathaniel Garrow read on, absorbing the words of the tracts page by tattered page. Although he would never have showed it openly, the passing hours had shaken him to his core. He had always imagined himself as a blade in the Emperor's hand, or as an arrow in mankind's quiver to be knocked and sent tearing into the heart of humanity's foes. But what was he now? All the blades were blunted and twisted upon one another, the arrows broken about their shafts. The firm ground Garrow's belief stood upon was turning to quicksand beneath them. It was almost too much to contain within his mind. His brothers, his battle lord, his very war master, all ranged against him. The blood of a death guard on his sword, and much more to come. The foreboding pall at the boundary of his thoughts, the omen of the blinded star, the smug prophecy of the dead Xenos child, and Caleb's dying plea. "It's too much!" Garrow shouted, and sank to his knees, the papers tight in his hand. The horrible taint of this knowledge was a poison that threatened to shrivel his soul. Never, in centuries of service, had the Astartes felt himself to be so totally, so utterly vulnerable. And in that moment, he understood there was only one to whom he could reach out.
"Help me!"
he cried, offering his entreaty to the darkness.
"I am lost!"
Of their own accord, Garrow's hands found the shape of the Aquila, palms open across his chest.
"Emperor," he choked, "give me faith."
Behind his eyes, Garrow felt something break loose inside him and leap, a sudden release, a flood of energy. It was beyond his ability to describe it, and there, in the gloom of the half-lit alcove, he felt the ghost of a voice brush over the edges of his psyche. A crying woman, pale and elfin, strong and delicate all at once, was calling him. The voice from his dream.
"Save us, Nathaniel."
Garrow cried out and stumbled backwards, fighting to recover his balance. The words had been so clear and close, it was as if she had been in the chamber with him, standing at his ear. The Death Guard recovered his composure, panting hard, and got back to his feet. He sensed a peculiar, greasy tang in the air, fading even as he noticed it. The stroke upon his thoughts had been like the Yorghali's intrusion into his mind, but different. It shocked him in its intimacy, and yet it did not feel wrong, like the telepathic touch of the alien. Garrow took a shuddering breath. As quickly as it had happened, the moment vanished like vapour. He was still staring at the bundle of pages in his hand when Decius stormed into the chamber, anger tight on the younger man's face. Solon Decius watched his commander stuff a fold of papers into a belt pouch and turn away, as if he wasn't ready to look the Astartes in the eye.
"Decius," he managed. "Report."
"Resistance was encountered," he growled. We dealt with the remainder of Grolgor's men. They made an attempt to reach the landing bay. We suffered some casualties as they were repelled."
Decius's face became a grimace.
"It was a slaughter."
Garrow eyed him.
"They would have done the same to us if we had given them the opportunity. Why else do you think the Typhon placed both Grolgor and me aboard this ship, if not to have my command terminated when the moment came?"
Decius wanted to snap out the angry reply boiling in his thoughts, to say that maybe that was true, but perhaps it was only Garrow who had been on the target list. He stared angrily at the deck. What exasperated him more than anything was that he had not been given the choice. His fate was tied to the battle captain's now, whatever happened. Yes, perhaps this might have been what Decius would have chosen had he been given the opportunity, but the sheer fact he had not made him rebel against it. His mentor read the emotion on his face.
"Speak plainly, lad."
"What would you have me say?"
Decius retorted hotly.
"The truth. If not here and now, then you may never get another chance," Garrow replied, keeping his tone level. "I would have you speak your mind, Solon."
There was a long pause as Decius worked to frame his resentment.
"I put down three men wearing my own colours back there," he said, jerking his head at the corridor and the ship beyond. "Not Xenos or mutants, but Death Guard. My brother Astartes.
Those men ceased to be our brethren the instant they chose Horus's path over the Emperor's.
Garrow sighed.
I share the pain of this, Solon, more than you can know. But they have become traitors.
Traitors?
The curse exploded from him.
Who are you to decide that battle, Captain Garrow? What authority do you have to make such a determination, sir? You are not Warmaster, not a Primarch, not even a First Captain. Yet you make this choice for all of us.
Garrow watched without responding. Decius knew that daring to take such a tone with a senior officer was worth punishment and censure, but still he raged on.
What if it is we who are the traitors, Captain? Horus will no doubt paint us as such when he learns of what you have done.
You have seen what I have seen, said his commander evenly. Tarvitz, Grulgor, the kill orders from Eidolon and Typhon. If there is an explanation that would undo all of that, that would make this all go away, I would give much to know it.
Decius advanced a step.
There is something you fail to consider. Ask yourself this, my lord. What if Horus is right?
He had barely uttered the question when the combat alert sirens began to wail.
Say that again,
snapped Temeter, pulling the Astartes holding the long-range vox towards him. With the constant drumming of shellfire back and forth between the Death Guard assault force and the Istvanian defenders, it was difficult to hear the man's words. Another blistering salvo of Vulcan bolter fire from the Dies Irae roared over their heads, blotting out everything else as the Titan continued its slow advance.
Lord, I have fragmentary signals. I can't make head nor tail of them. Just give me what you have,
Temeter said, crouching down behind a broken ferrocrete emplacement, ignoring the whine of needler rounds and the snap-crack of crimson laser beams.
Still nothing from the orbital elements,
continued the Death Guard.
I caught an intercept to the Sons of Horus, Squad Lacoste from Lucius of the Emperor's Children. Lucius? What did he say? It was very garbled, sir, but I distinctly heard the words, bio-weapon.
Temeter's eyes narrowed.
Are you certain? There was nothing in the mission briefing to indicate the Istvanians have that capability. This is their holy city, after all. Why would they deploy something like that?
Temeter suddenly broke off and looked up. The overlapping sounds of the battle had become background noise to him, a constant rush of shot and shell, but suddenly something had changed. It was the Titan. The Dies Irae was only a few hundred meters from where Temeter crouched, and he had quickly become accustomed to the ground-shaking impacts it made with every footfall, anticipating the rhythm of them. But the massive humanoid machine had stilled, and now it stood there, a vast iron citadel, joints hissing and ticking. Mortar shells arced past them and impacted harmlessly on Dies Irae's torso hull, drawing no reaction from the crew. The Titan's mighty guns were still pointed directly at the enemy lines, but they were silent.
What in Terra's name is that fool up to?
Temeter snarled.
Raise the Titan! Get Princeps Turnit on the vox and have him explain himself.
The captain of the Fourth Company scanned the hull of the machine with his optics. There was no visible damage of such scale that would cause a Titan to shut down. No possible reason that Temeter could see for it to just stop. His line of sight passed over the access hatches in the hull, and he saw all of them were shut fast. Temeter searched for and found power shaft vents in the thigh armor of the mechanism. Normally they would be puffing with the release of spent coolant gases, but instead they were sealed. Chill knives of apprehension stabbed into him.
I can't raise the Dies Irae, said the other man. Why don't they answer? They must be able to hear us.
A bioweapon.
Temeter reached up and checked the seals at his neck, a creeping sensation of trepidation coming over him. The captain's head tipped back, his gaze moving to take in the yellowish sky over the Titan's huge iron shoulders. He saw twinkling glitters up there, streaks cutting through the upper atmosphere with trails of white vapor behind them. The sight shocked him into action.
Squad wide comms now!
He shouted.
All Death Guard disengage and seek cover! Bio-war alert! Make for the bunker complex to the west!
The other Astartes relayed his orders into the vox, even as he and Temeter broke from their meagre cover. Temeter saw the dreadnought Huron Fowl turning in place.
Ulis Temeter!
The venerable warrior's synthetic machine voder was loud and scratchy.
Who has done this?
No time, old friend, he said on the run. Just get the men inside now!
With every pounding step he took, a part of Temeter's mind was reeling with the import of what was taking place. The bombs were falling, and there was only one person who could have sent them.
Garrow and Decius made it up the ramp to the windowed gallery overlooking the barracks chamber, in time to witness the ships of the War Master's fleet open fire on Istvan III. A myriad of silver streaks, almost too fast to see with the naked eye, streamed over and around the Eisenstein and the other smaller ships at low anchor above the Coral City. Although they were just blurs, Garrow didn't need to see them clearly to know what they were. Atlas-class heavy warheads, converted for space-to-surface functions, servitor-guided missile bombs and multiple impact penetrator munitions. It seemed as if only Eisenstein's guns remained silent, as if every capital ship in the 63rd Fleet were taking some part in the brutality. The bombs came in a solid rain of murder, falling fast, turning and converging towards pre-designated target points all across the planet. From this terrible god's-eye view of the onslaught, the distant grey-white patch upon the main continent that was the Coral City was easily visible. Garrow watched in abject horror as the instruments of Horus's betrayal flared red as they punched through the atmosphere and fell upon his battle brothers. At his side, Decius's face was wrapped with a peculiar, grotesque fascination as he struggled to comprehend the magnitude of the destruction.
Temeter and Huron Fowl were at the shallow ridge before the bunker's steel hatch, shouting at their kinsmen to run and run, to run and not look back. Temeter felt a pang of fear, not for himself, but for his men. They had responded perfectly to his command, falling back in good order and surging away from the enemy along the trench lines they had already cleared. Hundreds of them were already in the bunkers, sealing themselves in to weather the imminent bombardment. But there were many more he knew would not live to make it to the doors. He looked up again at the sickly sky, and Temeter became torn inside.
"Who betrayed us?" he asked himself, echoing the aged dreadnought's question.
"Why, in Terra's name, why?"
"Ulis!"
barked the old warrior, stomping to his side.
"Get in there! We have only a few seconds!"
"No,"
he retorted. "My men first!"
"Idiot!"
growled Huron Fowl, throwing protocol to the wind.
"I will stay. Nothing will be able to crack my hide. You go now."
He shoved Temeter with his colossal manipulator claw.
"Go inside, damn you."
Ulis Temeter stumbled back a step, but his gaze was still on the sky.
"No,"
he said, just as flickers of brilliant light turned the day a glittering white. At high altitudes overhead, the first wave of the virus warheads detonated in series, a wall of airbursts instantly unleashing a black rain of destruction. The viral clades, capable of hyper-fast mutational change and near-exponential growth rates, feasted on native airborne bacteria. The thin, dark bloom of the death cloud rolled out over the Coral City, just as the second wave fell. The shells did not explode until they hit the ground, bursting to smother city districts, open fields and trench lines with tides of destructive haze. The Life Eater did as it had been engineered to do. Where a molecule of it touched an organic form, it spread instant putrefying death. The Coral City, every living thing, every human, animal, plant, every organism down to the level of microbes, was torn apart by the virus. It leapt boundaries of species in a second, burning out the life of the planet. Flesh rotted and blood became ooze, bones shredded and turned brittle. Istvanians and Astartes alike died screaming, united in death by the unstoppable germs. Temeter saw the warriors running towards him, dying on their feet. Figures fell to the mud as their corpses turned to a red broth of fleshy slurry, viscous fluids seeping from the chinks in their power armor. He knew that he had dallied too long, and he shouted with all his might, "Close the hatch! Close it!" The men in the bunker did as he told them, even as he tasted blood in his mouth and felt his skin prickling with budding lesions. The metal door slammed shut and hissed with a pressure seal, locking him out. Temeter hoped they had been quick enough. With luck, they would not have taken any of the virus inside with them. He managed two stumbling steps before he fell, the muscles in his legs singing with agony. Huron Fowl caught him.
"I told you to run, you fool!"
The captain flung off his helmet with a final agonized gesture of defiance. It was useless now, the virus having moved effortlessly through the breather grill and into his lungs. His hand flailed at the metal flank of the dreadnought and traced a runnel of dark fluid. Even through the pain, Temeter understood. There was a small fracture in the old warrior's ceramite casing, not enough to have slowed him on the battlefield, but more than the virus needed to reach inside the dreadnought's hull and savage the remnants of flesh inside.
"You lied!"
"Veteran's prerogative," came the reply. "We'll go together then, shall we?"
Huron Fowl asked, embracing Temeter's body to him, moving swiftly away from the bunker. It took every last effort from Temeter to nod. Blinded now, he could feel the tissues of his eyes burning and shriveling in his head, the soft meat of his lips and tongue dissolving. Huron Fowl's systems were on the verge of shutdown as he stumbled to a safe distance, skidding to a halt.
"This death," rasped the Voda. "This death is ours. We choose it. We deny you your victory."
With a single burning nerve impulse, the mind of the warrior at the heart of the dreadnought uncoupled the governor controls on his compact fusion generator and let it overload. For a moment, there was a tiny star on the battered plains outside the Coral City, marking two more lives lost within a maelstrom of murder. Garrow turned away from the blossom of darkness across the dying world and glared at his protégé.
"Now, do you believe it? With a planet scoured of life before our eyes, do you have proof enough of this madness?"
Decius spoke in an awed whisper.
It is incredible, the power of such destruction."
Garrow felt unsteady and held out a hand, placing it on the thick armor glass of the gallery window.
"It is not over yet. There is one more strike to come before this killing is complete."
"But the virus, it is consuming the whole planet, all life, everywhere. What other devastation can the War Master turn upon it?"
Garrow's words were weary and hollow.
"With so many dead, so fast, the Life Eater burns out quickly. But the mass of corpses it leaves behind moulder and rot."
His face soured.
"The remains turn to gaseous putrefaction and decay. Imagine it, Solon. A whole world turned into a gigantic charnel house, the very atmosphere stinking and choked with the stench of new death."
Out in the fleet, the ships were shifting, the formation parting so that a single vessel could move into a predetermined firing position. It was the War Master's flagship, the bright sword blade shape of the vengeful spirit.
"Of course," Garrow said bitterly. "Horus. He comes to make the killing shot himself. I should have expected no less."
Garrow wanted to close his eyes, to look away, but everywhere he turned his gaze he was haunted by the faces of the men that he had left alone down there. He saw Temeter and Tarvitz, imagined them dying in the onslaught, hoping, even praying, that they might have survived the first wave.
Now they must survive the final blow.
The vengeful spirit drifted to a halt and turned with stately menace to point her bow down at Istvan III. In the silence, there was a flicker of light from the mores of the warship's twin lance cannons along the flanks of the hull. The bolts of blinding fire touched the atmospheric envelope of the planet, and a new colour bloomed among the blackened clouds, the searing orange of a firestorm.
A match to tinder, breathed Decius.
The fumes from the decayed dead are lit. The flames will burn across the world.
All by the hand of Horus, said Garrow,
fighting off the sickness in his heart. They stood there for what seemed like hours, watching the fires cross continents and raise cities as the War Master's flagship orbited above it all, the lone arbiter of Istvan III's destruction. Time fell away as the two Astartes stood witness to the distant slaughter. At last, a loud chime sounded through the chamber over the frigate's intercraft voxnet and shattered the silence.
Captain Garrow, to the bridge.
It was Karai's voice, low and toneless.
We have a problem.
Nathaniel finally turned from the windows and walked away. Decius remained a few moments, his eyes glittering, before he followed suit, running to keep up with his commander. Barak Karaya couldn't bring himself to look out of the bridge's forward viewports. The slow death of the planet below was abhorrent to him, a brutal act that went against every fibre of his being. He had not taken an oath of fealty to be part of such horror. He scanned the chamber and found Mars glaring at him from the vox alcove, still gripping the message slip the shipmaster had given him. He advanced towards the junior officer, working to maintain his outward mask of authority.
"Is it done?"
he demanded.
Mars grimaced. "I have sent the signal you ordered me to send, sir."
The young man's displeasure was clear on his face, although Karaya could have cared less for his unwillingness to broadcast what was an outright lie. The master snatched the paper from his grip and shredded it between his fingers. The message had gone to Terminus Est with Grolgor's command rune carefully forged by Vort. In terse phrases that he hoped would emulate the speech of an Astartes, Karaya had informed First Captain Typhon that Eisenstein had suffered a weapons malfunction that prevented it firing on Istvan III. It was a poor ruse, as thin as the paper he had scribbled it on, but it would buy them time.
"What you have done will cost you your rank," hissed Mars in a sullen voice. "You are upon the verge of open mutiny against the War Master's command."
"Get your terms straight, boy," retorted Karaya. "Mutiny is when the enlisted men take over a vessel. When the ship's master does it, it's called barratry.
Whatever name you give it, it is wrong."
"Wrong?"
Karaya's anger went white hot in an instant, and he grabbed Mars by the scruff of the neck, dragging him from the alcove and across the bridge.
"Do you want to see wrong, boy? Look at that!"
He forced the Vox officer's face towards the viewports and the distant carnage. He gave him a half-hearted shove.
"Now get back to your damn station and keep your thoughts to yourself."
Vort came to his side.
"Sir, your pardon. The other ship, I have confirmed it. It's on an approach vector at full military thrust."
"Within gun range?"
She nodded. "I've taken the liberty of getting a firing solution, although that earlier trick won't work this time. If we kill it, the whole fleet will see." The bridge hatch irised open, and the commander of the 7th Company entered with one of his men, his eyes hollow.
"Shipmaster," said Garrow gravely, "is there a matter of urgency?"
He nodded.
"There is. Russell, show him."
Vort manipulated the controls on the hololith to display a close-range globe of space around the frigate. A red arrowhead was moving steadily towards the vessel.
"Another Thunderhawk," she explained, "on an intercept vector."
"Tarvitz?"
asked the other Astartes, the one called Decius.
"Has he been in orbit all this time, or returned from the surface?"
Russell shook her head.
"No, this ship's ident codes are different. The designation is 9 Delta. It belongs to the Sons of Horus, assigned aboard the Vengeful Spirit."
"He knows,"
said the Vox officer.
"Horus knows what happened here. He's coming to..."
"Shut up, Mars!"
snapped Karaya.
"He could be right,"
said Decius. Garrow ignored the hololith and went to the viewport, searching for the transport with his own eyes. After a moment, he pointed.
There, I see it.
Captain, what are your orders?
The shipmaster shifted uncomfortably, perturbed by the strange sensation of events repeating themselves. This was how it had all begun, with a lone thunderhawk, with Tarvitz and his warning. Some emotion Kariah couldn't identify crossed Garrow's face like a cloud passing before the sun. Then he turned on his heel and marched to the communications panel. Without preamble, he snatched up the vox pickup and spoke into it.
Thunderhawk gunship, identify yourself!
Garrow glanced back at Vought and threw her a look that said, be ready. A throaty voice, thick with a Chthonian accent, growled from the speaker.
My name is Iacton Cruz, formerly of the Sons of Horus.
Formerly? Repeated Garrow.
Yes, formerly.
Decius nodded to his commander.
I know this one, sir, an old campaigner past his time. The third captain under Horus. They call him the Half-Herd.
Garrow took this without comment.
Explain yourself, he demanded.
Kariah found that his hands were tight, his knuckles bloodless with the tension. He heard the agony beneath the veteran's next words, even through the crackling hiss of the vox channel.
I am no longer part of the Legion. I can no longer be a party to what the War Master is doing.
The battle captain held the vox away and rubbed at his face.
It could be a ruse, insisted Vought. That transport could be packed with Astartes from Horus's ship.
Let them come, growled Decius. I would prefer honest battle to all this subterfuge.
Or perhaps a bomb.
No.
Garrow's voice brought silence.
She is aboard. He does not lie.
She? Kariah's brow furrowed. Who is he talking about?
There are refugees on that vessel, I am certain of it. Open the landing bay and prepare to take the Thunderhawk aboard, he ordered.
The blocky ship maneuvered uneasily into the capture cradle, and the thrusters flared out. With grinding hisses, the deck servitors worked the manipulator arms to bring the Thunderhawk forward and down onto the same grating where Garrow and his men had arrived less than a day ago. Haker and his squad were ready with their combi bolters cocked and aimed, but Garrow refused to draw a weapon. He saw Voyen and the others watching him carefully, the question clear on their faces. They thought him mad to do this, he realized. He would have said the same in their place. He did not blame them, but then they did not see as he did. Even Garrow himself found it hard to articulate the compulsion he felt in his heart. He had knowledge. That was it. Although he could not explain it, he knew with absolute certainty that the ship before him carried a cargo as precious as the warning he had dedicated himself to delivering. The dream. It all came back to the dream. The Thunderhawk's forward hatch spat atmospheric gases and yawned open, allowing four figures to disembark. At the head was a craggy, aged warrior in the power armor of the Sons of Horus. He walked with the same stiff pride Garrow had seen in 100 other Chthonian Astartes, but his expression was one of sorrow, of a soldier who had seen too much. He bore the signs of recent combat, new wounds still wet with freshly clotted blood, but he paid them no mind.
"So, you are Garrow," he said. "Young Garviel spoke of you once or twice. He said you were a good man."
"And you are Iacton Cruz.
I would like to say well met, Captain, but that is as far from the truth as it could be."
Cruz nodded heavily.
"Aye."
He paused for a moment and then met Garrow's gaze.
"You'll want this, then, I suppose."
The old warrior held out his bolter, and the other Astartes tensed at the motion.
"Take it, lad. If you mean to end us, then do it with this. If that is to be the way of things, we can run no further."
Garrow took the gun and handed it away to Sendek.
"I'll have it cleaned and return to you," he said. "I fear I will need every able man in the coming hours."
The captain stepped forward and offered Cruz his hand.
"I have a mission," to take warning of Horus's perfidy to Terra and the Emperor. Will you join me in this?
I will, at that,
Cruz said, accepting the gesture.
I pledge my command to your mission, such as it is. I'm afraid all I have to offer from the Third Company is a single Lunar Wolf getting along in his years.
Lunar Wolf? Repeated Decius. Your legion!
The old soldier's eyes flashed with anger.
I'll not be known as a son of Horus again. Mark that well, lad.
Garrow gave a small smile.
Just so, Captain Cruz. I welcome you to the motley company of the starship Eisenstein. We number less than 100 battle brothers.
Enough, if the fates smile kindly.
Garrow nodded at Cruz's injuries.
Do you require a medico?
The Lunar Wolf waved the question away, instead turning to gesture to the other passengers from the shuttle.
I am remiss. Lucan asked me to keep these people safe, and that I've done by bringing them here. You should greet them, too.
Nathaniel looked down at an elderly fellow and recognized him instantly.
You! I know you!
The old man wore the robes of a highly ranked iterator, now somewhat the worse for wear, but still with the manner of his esteemed office beneath his troubled expression. He managed a weak smile.
Well, if it pleases the battle captain, I am Kirill Sinderman, primary iterator of the Imperial Truth.
The words trickled out of his mouth by rote, but the pat response crumbled as he said it.
Or at least I was. I fear that in recent days I have come to a moment of transition.
As have we all,
agreed Garrow, musing for a moment.
I remember I saw you on board the Vengeful Spirit passing through the landing bay. You were going somewhere. You seemed disturbed.
Ah, yes.
Sinderman threw a look back at the other two passengers.
Such is my vanity that I hoped you might have known me from my speeches. But no matter.
He composed himself. Clearly the escape from Horus's ship had taken its toll on the man. Sinderman placed a wary hand on Nathaniel's vambrace.
Thank you for the sanctuary you have granted us, Captain Garrow. Please allow me to present my companions. The Lady Mercedes Oleton, one of the Emperor's documentarists.
A remembrancer?
Nathaniel watched with interest as the ebon-skinned woman's head emerged from beneath a roughly woven travelling hood. She had a peculiar skull that extended beyond the back of her neck far more than that of a normal human, and it shimmered like glass. He instantly thought of the Yorgal Psyker, but where that Xenos child had been a thing of haphazard ugly mutation, the documentarist was dainty and brimming with grace, even under these trying circumstances. Garrow caught himself staring and nodded.
My lady, forgive me. I have never met a storyteller before.
She was quite different from what he had expected. Oleton seemed as if she was made of spun glass, and he was afraid to touch her for fear she might break.
You remind me of Lucan,
she blurted suddenly, the outburst seeming to surprise her.
You have the same eyes.
Garrow nodded again.
Thank you for the compliment. If it was Captain Lucan's desire to see you kept safe, then it is mine as well. Do not fear.
Sinderman saw the brittleness in her and gently guided the remembrancer to one side.
One other refugee, Captain.
Nathaniel saw the last figure, and his throat tightened. It was a woman in simple robes. He blinked, unsure if what he saw before him was real or some kind of strange vision.
You,
he managed. Garrow knew her, even though they had never met. He had felt the salt tang of her tears on his face, the ghost of her voice in the depth of his healing trance, and again in the barracks.
My name is Euphrates Keeler,
she said. The woman laid her hand flat upon his chestplate and smiled warmly.
Save us, Nathaniel Garrow.
I will,
he said distantly, for long moments losing himself in her steady, shimmering gaze. With effort, he tore himself away and gestured to his men to stand down.
Garrow took a breath and beckoned Voyen.
Get these civilians to the inner decks, where they will be safer. See to their well-being and report back to me.
Cruz hovered at his side.
Do you have a plan of action, lad?
We fight our way out, said Haker as he approached. Punch through and go to the warp.
Blunt and direct. How very like a death guard.
Haker eyed the lunar wolf.
I've often heard the same said of your legion.
The old Astartes nodded.
That's true enough. The humours of our brotherhoods do find themselves in lockstep.
He looked at Nathaniel.
To battle, then?
Garrow watched Keeler and the others walk away, his thoughts conflicted.
To battle, he replied.